Welcome to the HMO Success Podcast. I'm your host, Wendy Whitaker-Large, and I'm here to help you create a profitable HMO portfolio. Whether you're a brand new investor or you've been at it for a number of years, my podcast is here to help you make the most from your business, whether that is starting up, scaling, or systemizing. Please hit the subscribe button to make sure you never miss an episode. And if you've got an awe-inspiring project, an inspirational investing story, or a unique approach to HMOs, I'd love to hear from you. This week, I am really thrilled to have a very special couple on the podcast because they are a couple who worked with me on the mentoring program for a year while they started to develop their HMO portfolio. And as you will see, those of you who are watching on YouTube, you will see, if you're not watching on YouTube, I will describe this very youthful young couple. They're not the usual age of people that I work with, which is normally 35 plus. Tom and Izzy are a young couple who approached me and have made a great success of their HMO portfolio. And I'm really, really pleased to have them tonight on the whether you're watching this as a webinar or listening to it as a podcast, because I think you'll find their story really inspiring. And certainly what they've achieved has been absolutely phenomenal. So Tom and Izzy, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having us, Wendy. Good to see you.
Great to see you too. So, as you know, I always start with a quick fire round of five questions, and you don't know what these questions are, so don't worry. I'm not going to be asking you about the building regulations part P, so it's nothing like that. So you're going to have to maybe take it in turns as to who wants to answer which question. But yeah, I think I will start with you, Izzy, actually. Let me start with you. So, the rules are five quickfire questions, answer yes, no, or a very short answer. And I'm sure that we'll go into more detail through the podcast. So number one, do you need experience in property before setting out on HMOs?
I would say no, as long as you have the right education and mindset.
Great. Okay, Tom. Is investing a long way from where you live a good idea?
Yes.
Great. Izzy, should people start looking at auctions if they can't find a good deal on the open market?
Yes.
Great. Tom, is doing this, building an HMO portfolio and a property business, hard when you're in a partnership?
Yes, it's hard either way. It's hard either way. I would argue easier in a partnership, but yes, it is hard.
Great, great. It's hard, but it's actually easier than doing it on your own.
Yeah, I would say so, definitely.
Okay, great. And then finally, maybe this is a question you may have to confer on this one. Which is most important to you? Room rents, mortgage payments, or getting all your money out of a deal?
Money out the deal, I'd say.
Yeah, at the moment, money out the deal because of our model.
Yeah. Fantastic, fantastic. Well, listen, guys, you did that very, very well. Tom was actually a bit more succinct than I was expecting, and Izzy was a little bit longer.
Yeah.
Usually I do blab on, don't I? Sorry.
No, it's always very, very good content, Tom. It's not blabbing on at all. So, guys, what I'd like you to do is just introduce yourself. Now, tell everybody about your background. How did you get into this? And what made you inspired to start investing in HMOs?
We'll get this.
Yeah, okay. So I'm Izzy. I am a co-founder of Easy Living with Tom, and we started our property journey back in early 2021. And to be honest, Tom was really the driver of wanting to get into property. I just knew I wanted to start investing my money. I worked as a project manager in tech, so I had been doing that for maybe 5 years when we decided we want to start doing this to generate some cash, and we were like ready and raring to go. So at that point, I think we were we were struggling. We didn't have any experience. Well, I had no experience in property. And as I say, only from like a project management perspective did I have any knowledge of the sector. But we knew we wanted to invest, and we knew we wanted to do it now. And the thing with me and Tom is we tend to, when we made a decision, we just go like full steam ahead, and it's all done within, you know, a matter of weeks or something. So then we started to look for a mentor, and then that's when we moved into you, Wendy. We had actually already started to find properties, and we knew where we wanted to invest in the area and stuff. So yeah, it was all just full steam ahead from that perspective. And before I go into that, all the story, I mean, do you want to give a bit of your background?
Yeah, sure. So hi everyone, Tom Strzycki, again, as Izzy's mentioned already, co-founder of Easy Living. My background is predominantly in design. From the age where I can remember my first memory, always like making things and putting things together, and also taking them apart to my mum's anguish a lot of the time. I started my property education, I guess, in my pieces of spare time during university. I was doing product design at the time. Left university, realised there was absolutely no product design jobs. So I quickly found myself actually in construction, which was very, very lucky, thinking back at it now, with the transferable skills that I've learned. So since leaving university, so about 12 years ago, I've been in construction ever since. I work predominantly now in the commercial fit-out sector, but have worked on very large schemes, up to kind of £300 million, £350 million, in the residential sectors and other civil construction sectors as well. I always knew property was something that I did want to get into. I knew that it had multiple streams of income coming from it, and also it diversified into many different areas and streams of income. So I knew it was a good base and foundation coming from an acting family, which had many variances of income throughout its lifetime. So I knew I wanted something a bit more secure, and I knew I wanted to invest. As Izzy kind of started to allude to, we basically knuckled down after uni. We had absolutely no money. We were renting. We've never had any kind of investment help from that perspective. So we worked really hard for our first 5 years. We saved for our first place. And we also saved a bit extra to start to put something towards some kind of investment at university.
So it sounds like when you met, which presumably was at uni, was it?
Yeah.
How you both got together. You obviously must have shared your aspirations, your goals, your thoughts about where your lives might lead. And you must have had some kind of shared values around saving so that you could buy your own house together, for example. That I think in maybe 20 or 30 years ago would have been a very kind of normal mindset to have. You know, we're going to leave uni, get a job, save and buy a place together or get married or whatever. But do you think in your generation that's still an aspiration, or do you think that people have kind of given up on that a little bit? They feel it's too difficult.
Yeah,
I have an answer. Yeah, that, but you feel free. Go on. Yeah,
I would say I think people know that they want to, but they think it's impossible, or they put barriers in themselves. I mean, from my perspective, my dad was a massive saver. It was like always keep your money close. Like, and we talked about money mindsets before. Well, I'm like to Tom, like, we've got a budget, who's checking in the money, all of this. So I always knew this would happen for me. I was like, I'll save, it'll work out, because that's the plan and that's how it works. Whereas I think some people don't see that as a plan anymore, because I don't think they think it's possible. I don't know, I think they get a narrative sometimes.
I think the landscape has changed dramatically for young people. I think there's so much negative press around the status quo of how you're life should be structured, what you were kind of touching on there, Wendy, in terms of, you know, you go to university, you get a job, you know, you buy a house, you get on the property ladder, and then, you know, you work your ass off until you retire, basically. And I think that landscape is changed for a lot of reasons. I think social media has had a huge impact on young people and kind of broadening their horizons, whether they be right or wrong. I think that the opportunists of this world have certainly grown, because you're constantly being in flux with seeing what great things people have done. And I think that can often be quite dangerous, because it is a facade and it is very much the end, or not even the real, you know, kind of reality of what the person on the other side of the screen is living. And I think, you know, for young people now, there are a lot more opportunities to do different things. I think roles have certainly developed a lot, especially even since I've, you know, been up to the age I am now. I think
there's lots of jobs that weren't even around 10 years ago, aren't there?
Exactly.
If you think about the proliferation, for example, in the social media manager job, 10 years ago, those are maybe just beginning, but no one really thought you could have a job as a social media manager where you'd manage somebody else's social media. You know, it just kind of wasn't really, it was a bit of a rarity. Whereas now there's hundreds of jobs for social media managers. So, yeah, you're right. The evolution of technology and lifestyle has very much changed. And I suspect that for a lot of people, they would love to have a kind of nomadic lifestyle where they travel and they do their online business and they've got their TikTok channel and, you know, they're making thousands of pounds a month by doing some maybe weird and wonderful dance every day, or singing a song out of tune, or watching their cat jump over hurdles and I don't know what, you know, and there is this kind of myth that, you know, that's a great way to live your life and make money. But presumably for every one of those that's a success, there's probably 1,000 people, if not 10,000 people, who couldn't monetize it. And they're left thinking, what am I going to do?
Yeah, and
I think even on that, like when I'd say property wasn't our first thing. Not saying we did the cat hurdling, whatever, but you know, we have, like, you know, they say, like, fail until you succeed. And like, we've done, like, even we were saying that, like, we both started working really young.
Yeah,
like
we've done
rum businesses,
app businesses,
we've done
events,
we've done this, that, and everything. So, but like that, when we came to property, we got to the point where we just, like, we wanted something solid that we knew we could rely on, and as more of like a long-term gain rather than this dream.
I think property posed two attractive things, which Izzy's touched on. I think the fact that you have a physical asset and you're not buying into a digital economy, which is really hard to value against as a physical thing, because it's not physical at all. And also, I kind of think that it gave us the right amount of investment funds to create the right amount of capital back in terms of realistic capital. So you're constantly balancing that risk. And I feel like what some young people see online now is it's that whole mentality of that get rich quick. I have nothing because I'm a young student. What can I invest £10 in and get £1 million back? You know, it's just completely unrealistic. But you do see some people marketing. Yeah, look, there might be the odd rare case. Great, if you invested in Bitcoin in 2014 or something like that. I mean, you're fantastic, right? But, you know, it's just not the truth, because, you know, people would have done that. I think property presented us with a structure, realistic attainable goals, and something that we could really work hard but also get the right remuneration for whilst balancing a full-time job. And I think we are quite risk averse, even though we have taken risks in property, we're quite risk averse in terms of, you know, where we put our capital. And I think with having full-time jobs, you know, we were able to go, okay, well, if we don't get tenants, for example, we can still pay the mortgage up to a point. So it's all about calculated risk. And I think that presented the right level for us, really.
Great. Okay. So let's go back to the point where you started to think about HMOs. What was going on in your minds at the time? And why did you think, yeah, we want to do HMOs?
Well, I brought HMOs to the table for Isabel. I've read a lot online about HMOs, and you know, the concept was quite simple. And also at the time I was working for a very small family-run residential conversion business. So what we did was, you know, redesign properties. It was a design and build firm. So we redesigned properties in sometimes to accommodate for HMOs as well. I kind of felt like the margin in buy-to-lets was slipping. I mean, obviously the interest rates at the time were really good. I'm sure compared to your years of experience, Wendy, you've probably seen it at kind of 10 to 15% at times, whereas now we're talking, you know, single digit figures. But I felt that HMOs presented a clear opportunity because there's more and more people in this world every day. You know, we're growing as a population. Space is becoming more limited, especially in this country. I just felt that it was a model that made a lot more sense. And I was going to do buy to let, but then you read about this and you're like, well, why would I do that kind of thing, you know?
And I think as well, we at uni lived in like HMOs or shared housing. Mm. So when we came into it, we already knew, like, when we lived in Nottingham, there was student cribs. But we were like, we want to do that. And we just knew we wanted to create like a high quality, like reasonable product, not necessarily for students, mainly for professionals or working people, but that high quality thing that I would want to live in. It was what we were like, we just knew we wanted to do.
Yeah, the reason why we didn't do students is because we were students. It's the same.
You're a bit too close to your own market at that stage, weren't you? And so from this initial kind of embryonic idea, clearly, yes, you met up with me, joined the mentoring program. But within that, you also created this amazing brand, Easy Living UK. And that really, I kind of feel, has become a very important element of your ability to design, develop and structure the business. How did that all come about?
So I'll probably let Izzy go in a second, but one thing that was absolutely pivotal for the creation of the brand was Isabel, because she studied psychology at university. So obviously from your program, you explain that the importance of a brand and personal brands, which I use on a day-to-day basis now. I think it is incredibly important. And what I've realized is people buy people from, you know, the business that I do now and all the way down through the smaller businesses that we've done. It's all about passion, and it's all about, you know, investing in someone else's idea for the right reasons and working with them in an honest basis. So I think that from a psychology perspective, it was really helpful for your knowledge to help structure that brand and really just understand how people are going to take to it and why we're doing the things that we're doing. Like you've said, you've touched on already, it really helped us focus on certain parts of the business. We quickly eliminated things that we thought that we might have to do, but it helped us prioritize things, which again has helped us a lot.
When we started, we started doing the branding because we were waiting to buy the house. You know, like we're going through the conveyancing and we knew we wanted to do the branding really well. And because of all of our previous projects, we knew how important branding was, like, especially when it comes to rum. We knew we really wanted to go do this proper brand journey. So we went through this whole journey about, you know, who do we want to be to people? Who are our clients? What do they want to know about us? What do we want to stand for? And we went through this whole journey and then came up with Easy Living, primarily because we wanted it to be a win-win for all the people we worked with. We wanted our tenants to have an easy life when they're with us. We wanted it to be a quick check-in process. We wanted them to feel like it was easy to report things to us, all of these things that would make it a nice place to live. We wanted investors to feel like it was, you know, convenient to invest with us, or easy because they could rely on us as people, or whatever that might be to them. And again, it's creating that kind of branding. But as I've described it there, that then lends itself to the way we speak to our clients. It lends ourselves well to we created all the colours that would relate to easy living. And to us, we were thinking of like sailing away to the sunset. So that was the colours that we came to. Yeah. And it just meant that every time we come to the table with someone, we have a clear message about how we speak to them and the way we portray ourselves on our website and the way we approach a deal and the margins we will accept on a deal, it's, all the things.
It's certainly made things a lot easier. I mean, the actual process was really difficult. And I know it seems like, you know, easy living is such a kind of, you know, it's not a very complex name. It's not like some Latin word or, you know, something that's been taken apart and put together. You know, branding can be a fairly simple idea, but the process is quite complex. And I think that what we've done really well with our brand is that we've translated that through to the images that we use, to our logo. You know, we've got five different colours which represent five different areas of our business. And yeah, like Isabel said, even things like the colour psychology side of things, again, dipping in on Isabel's course, it's small things like people can relate to colour, I don't know, a thousand times quicker than they can to actually words on paper. So again, the whole principle about having a colourful brand that felt welcoming was really important, because that translates into who we are. We are, you know, very transparent, welcoming people that want to have a conversation, really, and want to strive to achieve something that's beneficial for everyone, which, you know, I think is pretty much 90% of business, to be honest, in general, in my opinion. So
I think you've done an excellent job, and I'll put the link to your website on the notes, because I think many people try and develop a brand, many people understand the importance of it but aren't able to execute it as well as you've done. I think your brand execution is excellent. You have not only thought through, you know, the imagery, the logo, the colors, the visual element of it, but you've thought about your values, as you say, you've thought about the way you want to do business. And I think for a lot of people, when they're starting up in business, they don't realize how important that is. And to a certain degree, it's what the phrase that people, I think it was Maya Angelou who said, people will forget what you say to them, but they'll remember how you made them feel. And in a way, a brand is all about how do you make someone feel when they've seen it, when they're interacting with it, how do they feel about it? And sales is very much about feeling, you know, do I feel like I want to put my money with this pair, or, you know, are they a little bit dodgy? Should I run away?
Yeah, completely agree. We're just doing some website change. Well, we're about to embark on some website changes because we've got two great new business partners on board, who are helping us with other parts of the business. Namely, one of them is the kind of SEO back end and marketing side. So, watch this space. It is currently there, but that's V1, and we've got V2 coming up pretty soon. So it's going
to
be great.
Now, I'd like to talk about your very first project. So talk us through the numbers, if you don't mind, on that very first project, and also what you learned, because there were a lot, you had quite a lot of ups and downs on that initial project, didn't you? As I remember well.
Start with the numbers, I guess. Okay. Yeah.
So we'll start with the numbers. So the summary is we bought the property at $175,000. It was a two beds, one bath property over two floors. Well, two floors and a basement. And then we did a refurb of $50,000, including furniture, so getting the whole house ready for rent. And then we refinanced at $230,000.
235.
Yeah, 235 even. Yeah. And that was after converting it to a 6-bed HMO with 3 bathrooms over 3 floors, so utilising the basement space. And that allowed us to pull out 48,000
So most of your refurb money.
Yeah, so most of our refurb money, which was really, really, that's exactly what we thought we were going to get. So we were very happy with the outcome of that. And yeah, and Tom can probably go through the journey.
Yeah, just to finish on the numbers, I guess it's an important point. I think, again, online it's so easy to get caught up on, oh, you'll get 120% of your initial investment back and then you can recycle it again and again and again. Now, while that's all dandy and that's great, the principle, I think on the open market, which is where we bought this property, we didn't buy this one at auction, this was an open market property, that's easier said than done. It obviously can be done, but you know, you will be fighting for against probably a lot of other investors to get that same deal. In terms of the build and the challenges, yeah. it wasn't a straightforward property, as Isabel says. So, you know, it's technically not a basement. It's a lower ground floor. And these are the kind of small, minutia details that you do come to learn along the way. We had quite a few issues with building control on this kind of language and concept to make that basement space usable. And we introduced quite a lot of kind of fire, into the design, a lot of like different fire escapes and suppression tactics in order to, satisfy the building control needs of the building. I think the rest of the property was fairly straightforward. I think,
well, with your background as well, Tom, I think you were very good at project managing that. Because Isabel is a project manager, so I think both of you got those skills that really came together in this project. And I could see that because once you'd kicked off, we were, when I say kicked off, I don't mean having a fit. I mean, started the project, you kicked off the project. You probably may have kicked off in between time, but I didn't see that. But you were able to bring your professional understanding and knowledge to bear, which I think was very, very important, because this was the first time that you two had put your own money in. You had a limited budget, as everybody does, of course. None of us have unlimited budgets to do this. You were very strict about what you were trying to achieve and how you were going to do that. And you were very clear in your own minds about doing that. And therefore, you had to be very, very careful and cautious and really be pretty tight on what you could spend. But you managed to do that. You managed to negotiate throughout this with the builder and with the building control and or even on the refinance end, which initially didn't go too well. But then you pulled a blinder, which was
We did pull a bit of a blinder. Look, I'm probably underselling it. It was a really successful project.
I can think of three big challenges.
Yeah, go
which
on.
We overcame. The first one, I think we underestimated getting the builder.
Yeah.
And like finding a good builder, getting them started, like that took quite a while. And agreeing the quote and making sure everything is sound, and that took a lot longer than we anticipated. And we were happy with the builder we went with in the end, but that took a lot longer. I'd say number two was in the last couple of days, we were literally building all the furniture. I don't even need to go into that. Blinds was a big, putting up the blinds.
Yeah,
we won't be doing that again, I promise. And then the third was the refinance, which, again, I think is because it's unknown that you worry about these things. And the first one that we did, we had so many lessons from refinancing in that. You know, we didn't know that you could speak to the panel of interviewers if you wanted to, which when I ended up calling them, was made such a significant difference, because they, little did we know, they actually all specialise in different things.
Mm.
So some of them had no clue about what we were trying to do.
Mm.
And the first refinance we did didn't go particularly well, and they had valued it as just bricks and mortar. when we were going for a commercial valuation?
Well, this was the thing, right? So this was the big kind of error that we learned. I mean, the whole concept of hybrid valuations is really interesting. You know, because we had a six bed, we felt like the six bed was our perfect market because we didn't want to have to go through planning for sui generis rights on the HMO license, et cetera, et cetera. So while in principle that was really good, going up to a six bed, it's only as good as if every bedroom kind of has an ensuite. So if, you know, your listeners are thinking about doing a refurbishment that only covers, you know, having six beds, great, you get an extra bedroom, but you minus the bathroom. I'd actually argue it's better to maybe just think about doing five and three, because what they do really kind of hone in on is circulation space and livable space. And because we didn't initially get a commercial valuation, it was very much hindered by the fact there was no living space. Now, we've appealed to the umpteenth time, many times, both on mortgage valuations and stuff like that. And honestly, from our experience, it's not been a successful process. So we were lucky to have the escape of the commercial valuation where having the six bed came in. I mean, all of our house was to the property and the project was to standards in terms of, you know, the council's local plan, the spatial restraints and all the requirements that they had. That was never the issue. It's the fact that you there's all this legislation that everyone has to follow, from building regs to planning to, you know, spatial restraints and everything like that, that you feel like, great, you're just going to get the valuer in there who's going to do a tick box. But it's at that point where it actually becomes a very subjective process again, which is really peculiar, because I was kind of thinking, well, why do we have all these kind of requirements in place if it's just going to, you know, fall down to opinion towards the end of it? Now, we had our license, we had our HMO license, we had everything in place before the valuation, yet, and we thought we could quite easily get hybrid valuation, but merely because of the available living space, because we did a kind of, we didn't have a living room, we had a kind of kitchen and living space, and because there was only three bathrooms, which three bathrooms to six people is okay, you know, two to one isn't that bad in my opinion. Yeah. There were large bathrooms as well. You know, they still took the opinion of the fact it wasn't an HMO, which was almost laughable with regard to all the kind of you know,
yeah, everything we passed.
We really care about that stuff. You know, we're really passionate about making sure that we delivered on every single requirement that we had to, because it was our first one, and because we're risk averse, and because we wanted to get it right and actually do a proper job that tenants would, you know, want to live in, because we believe that, you know, if you go the extra mile, that actually you get rewarded back by people actually wanting to stay there. And people forget that it's a competitive market, even as a landlord. So I was really shocked by that.
You produced a really great product. At the end of the day, people love living there. You rented it out immediately, filled it immediately. Yeah. So from a point of view of being a commercial enterprise, it clearly did meet that requirement. But you're absolutely right. It's interesting, isn't it, how different surveyors, different valuers definitely do look at these properties slightly differently. And depending on their own background, their own expectations and their own parameters, either set by themselves or by their lender, will alter the way that they actually value your property. So, I mean, great on you both, though, for persisting, because I remember that day when you phoned to say, Wendy, what should we do? And there's an option to do a full commercial valuation. Should we go ahead and do it? And I said, yes, I know it's more expensive. I know you're going to have to fork out another couple of £1,000, but do it. And, you know, the proof is in the pudding.
Thank you. Well, you know, that really released, again, it goes back to just having a conversation. And I think that, as Isabel mentioned, by going through the commercial route, we were able to understand who the panel of valuers could be. And we called each one of them up, which we're totally in our rights to do. And we had a good conversation with all of them. And, you know, one definitely shone out of the rest, because, as Isabel mentioned, you know, some specialise in slightly different things. We created a good relationship with him, and we got the value that we needed to get for the project to work. So, yeah, lots of lessons learned taken from the project. I would say
some
actually
one,
yeah, some funnier than others. I would say definitely a big one was, I mean, you know, from my background designing, I felt as if I'd spec'd to my heart's content, but you know, it really is interesting working with builders. I mean, their market is hugely competitive, and they work really hard, and they also have to, you know, keep the jobs coming in. So the easier you make it for them to price things, the more coherent your project will be. And there's always going to be scope gaps. You know, that you take down the ceiling and you find stuff, right? So that happens. That's why we have contingency. But I feel like, you know, if you can standardize your HMOs in any way and regurgitate some of the specifications that you bring through, that's a really handy tip.
That's a great tip, actually. Yeah, that's a really great tip. You don't want to keep redesigning the wheel all the time, do you? You might tweak it, but you need to come up with some kind of template that you can utilize again and again and again and scale. Mm. So talking of that project, you know, finished, fantastic, all done. What then happened? What have you been working on since?
Well, we just after the project completed, we actually got engaged, which was great.
Yes, congratulations.
The next project turned to how are we going to pay for that? We quickly realised that we had our house in London, so we wanted to release that as an asset to bring in some income. So we did that. So that's rented. And we decided with the money that we got back from the first property in Doncaster, we would use that to move into our next project, which is where we're sat now, actually. So we were lucky enough to try the auction process with this one and moved into a bit of a do-er-upper, which, we're gonna call home for a few years, but also we're configuring it in a way that can be released after, you know, we're kind of done with it. And then I promised Isabel we wouldn't do any more projects until we got married.
Well, we're going to do some rent to rent.
Or we'll do some easier ones. Being the opportunist I am, an opportunity came to us through our new business partners, actually. And we just bought auction a development. It's a corner plot that we're going to be developing into 3 or 4 flats. So that's really exciting.
Amazing.
But the experience of using the auction process that we did for buying this house, we, you know, quickly saw the advantage of the additional margin you can possibly make. And actually, that really does de-risk it, because even though it's in a poor condition, it's still coming down, if that makes sense. And you still need to take it down and put it back. So in my mind, it actually does. Obviously, there are a lot more risks that do come with auction property, but when you've done maybe a couple of investment properties and you kind of know what you're doing a bit more, then you know, it's about calculated risk and mitigating those. So
I mean, when we did buy the house at auction, we were literally like, oh my god, we bought it to each other. We're like, oh my god, we just bought a house. So it was literally like eBay, because there wasn't even a person at the other side, like,
It was just
actually like eBay. We just put a number in and we're like, oh my god. But it actually really opened our eyes, because we did it through modern method of auction.
Yeah.
This one. And it was just seamless. It was just a much quicker version of pretty much buying a house, because we got a mortgage for this as well. So it really wasn't too different to what we'd experienced buying our other houses, other than the fact that it was so much quicker, and
yes,
was a positive. And then the second mortgage, the second auction property, did feel that was a bit riskier. It still had longer, so it was still modern method, so 50 days, but it was obviously a bigger, more rundown house than the one we're in right now. So it's been quite interesting. We've experimented with bridging. It's been a really interesting process and new in comparison to what we've done.
So it's probably a good time actually to mention, so we've got Jack and Jess as our two, Jess Hart and Jack Potter, who's come on as our business partners. Jack was our mortgage broker before. So he's come on to help us with the financing side of the business. And again, you know, kind of opened our eyes to the bridging element, which I was quite not against, but I was apprehensive. I didn't feel like I was ready to explore that avenue. But again, it's all about being practical, crunching the numbers. And actually, when, you know, you have those kind of conversations, you learn a bit more, felt a lot more prepared to go for it. So yeah, we're using a bridging method for this property. I think I'm working with an investor who's putting down the deposit for the bridging. And the best thing about the bridging is the interest is back charged to the end of the loan. So for us, you know, it gives us a solid year to complete the project, refinance it. And then, yeah, with the refinance, it's looking pretty healthy to pay the investor, the bridging, and retain the assets of the three or four flats that we're going to make. So
nice.
Like, it goes back to what you used to say when we were chatting about, like, mindset, because to me, what we're doing now just blow my mind. It's like,
yeah,
just,
a year ago,
I didn't even know, like, yeah. I wouldn't have even said yes to bridging. But then obviously Jack came on, he's an expert in this kind of area, talked us through all the numbers, and I'm like a numbers person. I need to see the numbers on a sheet. And it all just started to make sense. And again, it's just kind of like removing the fear a little bit.
Yes, exactly. And the great thing is, I think, because you have decided to kind of launch yourselves in, and you've always actually been like that, I think both of you probably don't realise that while you might say you're a bit risk averse, I think you look at the risks, you analyse the risks, but actually you always leap. I've never seen you both not leap. You've always taken that leap. So, yeah. I would never have said you're risk averse, but I do, because you don't procrastinate. You know, that's one of your greatest skills for both of you, is that you actually just keep moving forward, you know, taking a step at a time, moving forward, keeping the momentum going. You're not procrastinators. You might think you are, but I've never seen that in you. You keep going. And that is great, because it means that new opportunities are going to open up and new strategies will open up and you will learn and you will put them into practice. And then you'll think, hey, why did we ever worry about that? That's simple dimple. I can do that one, you know, and of course it's great, because as you do those strategies, when you learn how to buy at auction, you learn how to use bridging, maybe a lease option might be the next thing that happens upon your path. You know, you'll this world of property opens up and you suddenly realize, wow, there's so much here that we can put ourselves into, we can also learn from, and actually also you can build your wealth. And like you said earlier, Tom, it's about having an asset that puts money in your back pocket and builds your wealth. And you can then choose how to live your life, whether that's being digital nomads, where we started this whole conversation, or whether it's doing something else, or you know working or giving up your job. You know, you've got choices. The point is, you've got choices at that stage, haven't you?
That's it. We are just about to embark, just to finish your question, on our first rent-to-rent as well. By doing what we're doing, like you said, opportunities open up and your friends start to hear about what you're doing. And then, you know, people that you never thought might have an opportunity for you come out of the woodwork and kind of say, oh, you know, I've got this. We'd love you guys to kind of look at it and stuff like that. So, yeah, I think the great thing about bringing Jack and Jess on is that, you know, it's great to have our defined roles and see the business expanding in so many different directions at once, which is really nice. So, you know, having a power team has been so, so key. And I think you've been the real cornerstone of hammering that into us. You know, power team. And it is a buzzword, but it's also so important, and it's a buzzword for a reason, I guess. So, you know, I think building those right relationships around you and having those people to call upon gives you that flexibility, those options, again, learn more, de-risk all the different projects. I think when I first started the journey, Wendy, you know, I think I said to you, there was very limited amount of properties I was, you know, prepared to go for. But now every single property is a deal. In some way or another, so yeah, it's great to have that mindset and be able to work with it, really. So yeah
Now you're probably spoiled for choice, aren't you?
I wouldn't say that. I think, you know, we're still working full time as well, so it's.
I think that's like one of the hardest things, is like trying to say no, because we're like, we don't have enough time to do it all, so just try and
be patient,
slow and be patient.
Yes.
Patience is certainly hard. That's
for you.
Yeah, it's hard for me.
And also with a wedding to plan. And a future to plan as well. What's going on?
We only have one life event per year, and I'm sure we've had about six.
Well, you both look very, very good on it. Very, very good on it. And yes, it's really wonderful to catch up with you both and sharing your learning, your journey. And I know that Easy Living will go from strength to strength. And it's very exciting about these new business partners you've got who've joined you as well. As you say, Tom, it's a bit, in my mind, I imagine it's like a square. You're each at a separate point on that square, but you've each got your own almost circular network coming off from that square. So that brings a lot more into the centre, and there's a lot more there, isn't there, which is really, really exciting. So thank you both very, very much indeed for being my guests on the podcast this week. Really appreciate it. And as always, you know, it's a delight to see you, to speak to you, to understand where you're up to with everything. I'll put all the links if people want to get in touch with you. Maybe they want to see their money go a little bit further and they kind of like the sound of what you're doing with Easy Living and they'd like to get in touch. So we'll put those links on the bottom. Before we go, I would just like to get a couple of tips that maybe you can hand out to listeners who are thinking about investing in HMOs or thinking about mentoring. What are some of the biggest things that you could share with people? Maybe just two tips each.
It's my first and biggest one is it's never too late to start, and you don't need money. People buy people. So I don't get me wrong. It makes it slightly more complex with no money, but you know, if you learn to sell yourself and you have a structure and you have a dream and you have a passion, I would say that has got me a hell of a long way in certain areas for sure. So passion is key for me. And I think, you know, if not everyone gets everything right. So, you know, by having the passion, you're the first person to solve any wrongdoing as well. So that's important.
Right. And Isabel? What would you say?
Is to keep learning. I think the amount of times I came running to Tom, like, I've read this or I read that. And it's been like the most enlightening thing on our journey at that point. So keep learning and always add contingency. You'll always be pleasantly surprised.
Yeah.
You'll always be happy at the end. You're like, wow.
It's on very, very pragmatic tips there.
Easy tax. Yeah, exactly. Good deal.
Love it. Well, that's a very, very good way to end the podcast. Always have a contingency. I love it. Thank you very, very much, both of you, for your time and your efforts and energy. And I'm sure that Easy Living will go on to do greater and greater things. We'll keep an eye on your journey. Thank you so much for being my guest tonight.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the HMO Success Podcast. If you'd like to know more about how you can create a profitable HMO business, please visit our website, hmosuccess.co.uk, to find out more. We have plenty of free tools and information for you there, and also on our Facebook group, The Ultimate HMO Success System. We look forward to connecting with you very soon. Thanks for listening.